You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome
to Theater Geeks Anonymous,
the podcast about Broadway flops, scandals, and new work.
Now, we'll take a break from our usual episodes to bring you this intermission-sode. We're going to do, this episode's going to be an intermission.
Okay.
There's a lot to talk about. I know.
I just am going along with what you're saying. Yes. No, there is a lot to talk about. And I will actually, I'm going to preface this because it's kind of interesting. All of the stuff that you have sent me today and over the last couple of weeks of the things that you're wanting to talk about in this episode and then in the next intermission episode as well, kind of tie into an idea that my dad texted me maybe like 2 weeks ago. He texted me. He was like, "Hey, Pamela, you know what? You and Ebony should do an episode about how people are acting within the audience, because it's truly atrocious, the behaviors that are going on." But he thought about it because when we went to go, so I was home in January, home in Illinois, and my dad and I and my niece Trinity and then a friend went to St. Louis to see the musical Six, which was amazing. It was so good. And I want to see it again. And hopefully it won't be incredibly expensive for the remainder of its time on stage so that I can go see it. But the entire musical, the girl sitting directly behind me and like maybe two seats over was singing to every song. And I literally, like, I glanced back to, you know, to like make it clear that I was aware that she was doing that and I was frowning upon it. And she just kept doing it. And I was like, this is not a concert. I did not spend this kind of money to listen to you sing these songs. I want to hear the people on stage. It was maddening. And so like I was talking with my dad about that and he was like, "Oh, I mean, it's like going to a concert." And I was like, "Dad, if I was going to a concert, I would expect that people around me would be singing along with the people on stage. I'm not at a concert. I'm at a show." There's a certain level of decorum that you're supposed to have, but like now there are stories everywhere coming out. There was a story, Death of a Salesman, where a woman who was completely drunk decided to stand up in the middle of the show and get combative with, I can't remember the man's name right now.
Wendell Pierce.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wendell Pierce decided to get combative with him. And he was so gracious with her and like made sure that, you know, once she was gone, that, you know, he kind of calmed things down and then started the show again. But like, how awful would that be as an audience member and also as a person on stage to be, you know, like like affronted with that kind of behavior? And then you've got the people that are on their cell phones all the time and that are talking during the show. Yeah. I just saw a TikTok from the perspective of a man on stage saying that there was a woman in the audience that was talking on her cell phone throughout the show.
Let's talk about that for a minute, though, because the Wendell Pierce situation, Death of a Salesman has since closed. Yeah. But I was on, I think I was visiting my family while it happened. And so I come back and I see it, you know, my Broadway briefing and like any other places I saw it. And I was just like, oh man. Like
that,
what
I mean, and that was
what
extreme.
Is going on?
Seriously.
It was really bad.
Yeah.
It was really very like so disruptive. Show had to be stopped. And Wendell was in a very intense scene.
Yes.
The police had to come in and like escort her out. I mean, it was really horrible.
It really was.
And he was. I mean, he was a real MVP VIP. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He was like,
I do.
He handled it with the most amount of kindness. Like,
yes,
I mean, generosity. And it made me sad also because man, Death of a Salesman, I saw it. It was so good.
See it this time, but it is such a wonderful show.
Mm-hmm. And this particular production, what was so moving about it was that, you know, this time you have this underlying idea of, you know, when we talk often about systemic racism.
Yeah.
And you have this man who's been working in this company for X amount of years, and those younger than him who happen to be, you know, white are also getting, like, they're moving up in the ranks, they're getting these promotions. Yeah. And he's been sort of like the mainstay, like working, you know, his butt off, and then just sort of gets thrown away. It had a whole other aspect to it that I think in this day and time makes it much more relevant than, you know, especially right now.
Yeah.
Like, we need another play about white people feeling ostracized
anything.
When they, you know, and well, right. You know, when we're dealing
when they're
with
the ones that set the system up in the first place.
That's,
I mean,
right.
the whole reason Willie Loman in the original production is being cast out of his position within the company is because a white man set up that company in order to do just that very thing.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And
if you're too old, if you can't keep up, that all right. of that stuff, that's all patriarchal and that's all systemic racism right there.
It totally. And so it's ageism. It's like all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And also this production factors in race in a way that like other productions in the past have not. So then it's just like so sad that like the woman was of color and doing this.
Yeah.
And we feel, you know, it's a thing that like most white people, I don't know if they feel it in this way, but like we definitely as people of color, it's like when one person, one of us does something, the rest of us feel the weight of it, because then it's like we're all look through the lens of like, well, so and so did such and such. And so then they begin to see you and think that like you're going to act in the same way. And so we're just like constantly dealing with this. And there's like a collective shame that happens. And it was just like, you know, it was just like, really, ma'am? Really?
Yeah. I think speaking as a white woman in this world, we have something similar, but maybe not the same in that. And this is happening quite a lot, quite more frequently than I think anything has. And this will kind of lead into what else we're talking about today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there have been a lot of instances in the very recent past of white women using their tears and their privilege against Black people and sometimes getting those Black people killed.
That's right.
And that, I think, you know, if you are a person that is trying to be an ally, and I'm saying that about myself, like I want to be an ally. I want that as much as possible, but I don't know that I can really call myself an ally yet. Like it's a weird kind of, you know, middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
But the people like me that are trying, that do have empathy and compassion and want for all of us to have this equity.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one person does that, and then you almost feel like, are we ever going to get out of this? Like, is there anything I can do as one person to do it, like to combat all of these other things that are happening, all of these other people that are so vocal about their about their distrust and their hate for other people.
Yeah, I on the other side of that, as being, you know, a woman of color, there are times when I'm like, oh, good. Are we ever going to get from underneath
this
system? And I've just come to this conclusion that, like, things are different than they were when my mom and dad were young and my mom was being bused into schools. So at least that's not happening anymore. And
yeah.
So I'm like, things are definitely different. Are they where we want them? Absolutely not. But
no. No.
But it's that, like, you know how people talk about life being a journey? Every single day we make a better choice.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, we're one person, but if many one persons are making different choices every day, then that's a huge amount of people making different, better choices every day. And so it can feel insurmountable. I have gotten severely depressed in times. I mean, so deeply depressed. But I also feel like, you know what? I can't change everyone. I can just do what I can do. And that's a lot. You know, I mean, I especially in 2020, I was like, I just remember one week I was on, your girl was on the struggle bus. She was on Struggle Street. Okay. Yeah. She was on both. And out of that, like, came the think tank for theatrical innovation, which I, you know, started with a couple of friends, and we've been having these conversations. And those conversations have led people to make, like, different, better choices and to create work that's more IDEA and just, like, change their way of working. And it's like, that affects more people than just me, right? Like, that's more people than just me that are affected that I could never reach because I'm just one person. But if I sit down and I'm willing to have, like, these difficult conversations, these insightful conversations, conversations that stretch myself and my thinking and other people and their thinking, then, like, that's huge. And then they go and make those small different choices, and those small different choices affect other people, and it just keeps going and going, right? And so It's given me a lot of hope, because yes, like, the jerks are loud, and we're about to talk about some jerks that were super loud and obnoxious.
Yep. Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, I then think about, like, all the folks that condemned the actions of the loud, obnoxious people. There was, like, so many organizations that came out against this type of speak. And so I was like, you know what? Yes. There's always going to be somebody that is wretched. What do you, you know, it's just, it's the way the world is, but there's a lot of people who aren't, and a lot of people who are trying, and they're working on themselves and working on changing the way that they think and move through the world. And I just have to, I know that that changes things again, because we're not where my parents were when they were, you know, younger than me.
Well, I suppose if you look on the timeline of things, nothing ever happens overnight. It always happens over the course of decades or centuries. So yes, I'm glad that you feel hopeful. Maybe I'm just kind of in a depressive state at this point, but
it's totally understandable. Saying. Yeah. It really is understandable. And, you know, we might as well get into it. The next topic is going to be about these anti-Semitic protests that happened at the first preview of Parade. I'll be honest in saying I was not the least bit surprised that it happened. And one of the things that I feel like has been one of the things that's happened over these last few years, as people who are bigoted feel, you know, very free to express themselves, is that we see who they are.
Yeah.
And so now, instead of like, and I've used this analogy many, many times, and you all have heard me say it, but it's like, we now see all the roaches. So now we can like pull out the raid or whatever we need to, you know, to eradicate this, because if it just continues to hide, then you're like,
you're absolutely right.
You know, people really thought before Trump got elected that we were in an anti-racist country. This is so hilarious that people thought that. And so in seeing things like this, it then says, oh, this is why shows like Parade are important, because literally young people don't know the history. Like you know, Pamela, you're going to describe Parade and all of that, but like, this is actual living history. Okay. Like there are people still alive from this situation that happened. It was not that long ago. And so many people don't know about it. In fact, like anecdotally, I have a dear friend who grew up in the town where this happened. Grew up not knowing it had happened until they were in like high school, and they only had one teacher that addressed it.
Wow.
It's like this.
They didn't talk about it at all in my school. We didn't hear about this case at all.
Same. And you know, this person was like, I just had the one teacher. And I said, some of us didn't have the one. It's just that, like, you know, these things have happened, and people are so uneducated about our recent history, you know, that they then really, they don't know how bad it can get. And us not understanding our history really puts us in a difficult space where we begin to repeat it.
100%.
And that's why shows like Parade and Leopoldstadt, which is open right now, and then last year, 2022, the play Camp Siegfried, which a lot of people don't know about the Nazi camps that we had just here in like Connecticut and different parts of New York. People don't know about these.
Mm.
And so you need art like this to tell you, listen, this was in our own backyard. Okay. This is not like only Germany.
Right.
Okay. This is also here. And you need to know.
It's been here. I guess that's just it. It's like yes, of course it's in Germany. And yes, of course it was happening all over the world. But but where did all of the Americans that live here today come from?
Right.
We came from all of those other places, and we just brought our biases with us.
That's right.
And as well as the people that we then oppressed. Like it's so, you know, you look at it. And I this is what infuriates me right now.
Yeah.
Ron DeSantis down in Florida has decided to make it his life's mission, before becoming president in his own mind, to make it his life's mission to decimate any amount of knowledge about other people within his own state.
Yeah.
He's banning books left and right. And it's literally now an illegal thing to have any books in your classroom. And a teacher that has a book that is not approved can be arrested and charged for that. So now all of these teachers are taking out all of the books just to be on the safe side, right? So now you don't have any past knowledge because you can't read books.
Mm-hmm.
You can get on the internet, but I'm imagining that probably he's going to put some sort of like a parental block in place within the internet, within the technology that is given to them at school. You've got parents that are probably just as biased as Ron DeSantis that aren't going to go into any detail with their children. So you've got this entire generation of people that has not only essentially condoned the oppression of hundreds of years worth, right? But now they are oppressing their own children's generation.
That's right.
By not allowing them to know where their history is. And if we don't know our history, we are doomed to repeat it. And how often do we hear that phrase, especially now?
That's right. I was listening to a podcast this week, and this gentleman who was a professor at Harvard, and he has some data that's like seems to be controversial. But what I found, I'll send you the podcast and you can sort of listen to it and sort of understand why. But you know, one of the things he said, which I was like, I mean, there's a lot he said that I was like very interested in and agreed with, and some of it I didn't. but one of the big things he said was like, we've got to stop saying that our kids are too fragile and can't handle our history.
Right.
Like, we have to stop saying we need to shield them from the truth of this country.
If sweet little Ruby Brown could walk into a segregated school no longer as a child and be yelled at by adults and children alike and still be able to be brave enough to do that, then white children are going to be fine.
They're going to be fine. They're going to be fine, and they're going to learn some things, and they'll survive.
But the thing is, maybe it's because I grew up in a family that I did that was so accepting of everybody around us.
Yeah.
But when I was learning about slavery, when I was learning about the oppression of other races and also like disabled people and, you know, LGBTQ at the time, you know, to me, it never made me feel bad. It just gave me permission to do better.
That's right.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I mean, like, that's, kids are, you know, there's that song from South Pacific, you have to be carefully taught, because kids don't like immediately come in with a negative bias, right? They are taught how to be negatively biased. Like, I so vividly remember as a little girl having this friend when I was probably about 4 or 5 years old, and she was white. And she, like, we played on the bus every, like, going to school, coming from school every day, hand clapping for forever. And her sister was always trying to pull her away from me.
Yeah.
And I was the only Black kid.
Oh, and it took that's miserable.
Mm-hmm, it took me many years to understand, like, why she, because I was, you know, I'm a little goody two shoes, have been for so much of my life. It's not like I was like some negative influence. And so I always I was a bit confused about why that happened.
Sure.
And I didn't tell my parents because I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
I just noticed it. And and then as an adult, I'm like, oh, right. I see.
Sad.
Yeah. But she and I had no concept of, you know, any of that. Like, she, it was just, I was her friend.
Well, no, of course not.
She would constantly push off her sister and be like, leave me alone, leave me alone. But that's the thing, right? Is that, like, in teaching children that, yes, that friend you have is so lovely, and like, this is their history, and how can you love them even better? That's what's actually, that's what people are trying to do.
Right.
It's not, you know, and so I don't know. I just, it's concerning. But Pamela, I do want to ask you to give a synopsis of Parade, because we know for a fact we have like middle schoolers who listen.
Definitely.
And so this is a real education for them to understand that this thing actually happened and not that long ago.
Yeah. So, and I also do want to point out, we did a full episode about this. So after you listen to this, you can go back and listen to that as well.
Yeah.
And I'll go into like much more detail, but like the Cliff's Note version of Parade is, you've got Leo Frank and Lucille Frank. They are Jewish married couple in Marietta, Georgia in the early 1900s. This exact moment happened in 1913. What happened is Mary Fagan was going in. She was, I think, 14, 12 or 14. I think she was 14. Mm-hmm, going into work 14. At her factory job. Oh, thank you. Pencil factory job. Pencil factory that Leo Frank owned, to go and pick up her paycheck for that week. She then was discovered dead in the basement of that pencil factory. Almost immediately, Leo Frank was accused. I mean, there was another man
that was working in the pencil factory as well, that was also accused, he just happened to be a man of color. Then he was quickly, you know, said, no, you didn't do it. And Leo Frank was pinpointed. So he was falsely accused. He was essentially prosecuted in the paper by the media more than anything else. And there was a lot of like bias going on behind the scenes within the judicial system as well, which led to him being convicted of this crime in 1913. It basically life in prison, right? Except that he didn't make it to life in prison, because a couple of years after he was convicted, a lynch mob decided they're just going to go to the jail, take him out and kill him, because they wanted the justice that they wanted and they weren't going to wait for it. But decades later, on his deathbed, a man that was intrinsically tied to both the pencil factory and to the Leo Frank case came out with the information that it was actually another man named Jim Conley that worked also at the pencil factory that had indeed murdered Mary Fagan. And he was, there's something, and in the musical, it's very clear that the governor and Jim Conley are kind of like, you know, shaking hands behind the scenes about mm-hmm. Jim, you know, putting evidence towards Leo Frank. I'm not sure if that happened in real life, but mm-hmm. There was clear evidence against Jim Conley when there wasn't against Leo Frank, and yet mm-hmm. Leo Frank was still convicted of this crime.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in a nutshell, is Parade, and also kind of a little bit more of the backstory of Leo Frank. Mm-hmm. Now, this came out, I believe, in 98, 97,
yes, that's
98?
Right.
I can't recall exactly. Okay. I bought this CD almost as soon as it came out. And I was, this was like my junior year in high school. Listened to that thing on repeat. I loved it, right? But I was, again, more fascinated with the true crime aspect of it than anything else. Mm-hmm. So in this, you know, fledgling internet era, I was like looking up everything I could about Leo Frank and just mm-hmm. falling down rabbit hole after rabbit hole. Through my research, it was perfectly clear to me mm-hmm. that there was an injustice done, a horrible injustice done, right?
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. it wasn't so clear to them. And apparently it's not so clear to people today, because right. on the opening preview of Parade on February 23rd, there was a group of people, anti-Semitic people, that were protesting the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I did not understand this, because I saw the headline, but I was like, what are they protesting? Like the show itself? Like, I don't understand. Like, what is a bigot protest, right? What do you mm-hmm. do? Hold a sign up that says we don't like Jews? Like, but that's not what it was. It's this group of people. And if I can come across the name of that group, I will let you know. Oh, wait, mm-hmm. I think I have it. Oh, it's called the National Socialist Movement. It's a far right white supremacist group.
Mm-hmm.
These people have been in existence since the lynching of Leo Frank.
Mm-hmm.
They are people that will, every time Leo Frank's name comes up, will be there to protest the idea that he is innocent, because mm-hmm. they don't believe he is. One of the people that is a member of this group and was also protesting Parade coming to the theater in the initial show of 1998 and also of today's production is Mary Fagan's great niece, who truly believed, and this is very difficult, right? Because her relative was the one who was murdered, but even she truly believes that this man committed this crime. So even she is like protesting this, just the idea of him being innocent put in a show has just riled this group up so much.
Yeah. It reminds me of the jogger from the Central Park Five, the Exonerated yes. Five, because she, even though another man confessed to the assault and his DNA proves that these five young men had nothing to do with it, she still has decided to believe that they did it.
Well, and it's kind of like what's happening, you know, with everything that's coming out right now, with the election being rigged and with, you know, Leo Frank being innocent. Like, the proof is right in front of them, but nobody's choosing to believe that proof. They're just doubling down on the fact that that must be a lie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's crazy to me, but it also kind of makes sense in that if you believed this wholeheartedly, if you truly believe all of this that is in your heart and mind to believe, and suddenly right. someone says, no, actually it's not, and here's the proof, mm-hmm. what are you supposed to do with that? Like, your whole world is going to implode.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. That's really true. I mean, again, all I'm going to say repeatedly is that with what happened at the opening preview for Parade and mm-hmm. what we've seen in the news over the last few years, this show absolutely needs to be there. Leopoldstadt yes. absolutely needs to be there. Mm-hmm. I honestly hope Camp Siegfried is able to come back, because I didn't get a chance to see it. And a lot of people don't know about those camps. I only found out about those camps back in like 2017 when my brother was going to work on Long Island. And I was like, just curious about where the city he was going to be doing construction in. And found yeah. out like Hitler Street had only been taken away like a year or two before he was going to be there. There was still a Hitler Street by where the camps had been.
Explain for the people that don't know, what are these camps right. that you're referring to?
So if anybody has seen Jojo Rabbit, you'll have a little bit of an understanding. Now, Jojo Rabbit, of course, takes place in Germany, but the premise of that movie is basically there's this little boy who is a part of these youth camps. And these youth camps basically teach white supremacy and all of the Nazi ideals that Hitler held to throughout his reign. And so... in the U.S., there were several of these camps as well that popped up during the period of time where Hitler was rising to power and the Nazis and the Communist Party over there were rising to power. And there were several up in like through Long Island and Connecticut. And Camp Siegfried was one that was on Long Island. And the town that my brother was in had one as well. I'll be honest in saying I don't remember the name of that one. It could have actually been Camp Siegfried, but okay. they did have a Hitler Street. He was there in 2019. And the Hitler Street had just been taken down in like 2017.
That is, I am... mm-hmm. I am amazed at this information, because I grew up and I feel like you couldn't say Hitler, like right. if you unless you were talking about the historical relevance of it, like if you, these are words that you just don't say.
Right.
And so to have a whole street. Mm-hmm. I'm appalled.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because when I found that out, I a few weeks later, I was up in Long Island at a friend's house with his parents and stuff. And we were chit chatting and I, you know, told him what I had found, and it was not far from his house.
Really?
You know, and he was totally shocked.
Oh, my gosh. So he didn't even know.
No. And it was like, it was still like, you know, I told him what town, he was like, yeah, that's right. And I'm not in Long Island very much, so I don't actually know, you know, the location of like how close yeah. or far we were, but he knew exactly where the town was. And I was like, oh yeah. And that only came down in 2017. It's just like mind blowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that it was so recent, but this is why I say and said at the beginning of this episode, like recent history.
Yeah.
You know, because we think it's so far out, and I'm telling you about something that was only about what, like 5-6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 5 years. Yeah.
You know, so if you have a 5 or 6 year old kid, there was still a Hitler Street when they were born.
Just I think so you anything, know. Anything like this that
was finally called out in the 2000s.
Yeah.
It was too late, too late.
This was a year we started our podcast that the street just got changed.
Yeah.
So that's, friends, you know, we're going to talk more about Parade, the follow-up episode to what shows are upcoming. But this episode is like really just devoted to some things that are happening in the world and as that pertains to theater and social issues. And so we absolutely, of course, had to talk about this. And like I said, the response is like a lot of people have come out against it. You know, Eric Adams took to the stage to denounce what happened. Like every single union has come out against it. Mm-hmm. The producers made a statement against it. And so did
Jason Robert Brown came.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then also Ben Platt took to Instagram and did a video, which he doesn't do very often. And talked about it, you know, and it's wild, but not surprising.
Yeah.
You know,
and I guess that's the saddest part to me is that it's not surprising.
Yeah.
You know, so long we've been talking about wanting diversity on stage, not for diversity's sake, but because that's what's normal. That's what the world looks like. And that's the mirror that theater should show us. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think the same about the ideals and values of the people, of the human existence, of the humans that live in this world all together. That there should be an equity, not for equity's sake, but because that's just how it is. That if you're a person and I'm a person, that's where we meet in the middle.
Right. Mm-hmm. 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 Yep.
I do want to read something really quickly about from the Jason Robert Brown.
Please do.
What he wrote. It's really, I mean, there's a lot in it that's really interesting. So if you, I don't know where you found it, but if you can, if you want to give that information, it's definitely worth a read.
I get Broadway Briefing every weekday. And so they send a list of like, you know, articles that happen. So that's where I found it. But it's on Jason Robert Brown's website. And I believe it's like a blog post, right?
Okay. It seems like it. I mean, that's how it's written.
Yeah, So Pamela read it because my computer would not load it. but what I could see from the web address was that it was Jason Robert Brown's, you know, his website. So if you all just go to his website, and I think it's just jasonrobertbrown.com, you can go to the blog post and you'll find it. Yeah.
Right. So what I want to read is towards the end of it, and I will be editing this for language, mm-hmm. but Jason Robert Brown, these are his words. He says, "I feel terrible that audience members who are waiting in line to see our show on Broadway may be accosted by neo-Nazis. I can't believe I'm writing that sentence, but I'll tell you the truth. I'm glad the a-holes showed up. I'm glad they feel threatened enough to emerge into the light and show their faces. Mm-hmm. I suspect they don't particularly know or care about the case. They just want to yell out the words Jew and pedophile. Mm-hmm. They won't really engage with you. They can't. Everything they could tell you about Leo Frank and the case has been decisively debunked over and over again. No legitimate conversation about the murder of Mary Fagan will end with you believing that Leo Frank was guilty."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's facts on facts.
Mic drop. It's true. Well, and I will just because when I was searching Leo Frank on the internet in 1998, mm-hmm, all of the information that came up was factual. It was, you know, newspaper clippings and transcripts from the court case. Like all of that was the stuff that I was coming into contact with. Today's internet is not that internet. Today's internet allows for anybody and everybody to put whatever opinion they want on the web, right? And for anybody to read it. And there are white nationalist groups like this one who mm-hmm. put up information on the internet that is not true. And if you are not doing your due diligence in trying to research and make sure that that is an accurate portrayal of what is going on, then you will be misled. So I want to suggest that you go and look up these cases, because the Emmett Till case and the Central Park Five, Exonerated Five case, and the
Watch
Leo Till. Frank case.
Also Watch Till.
Oh, totally. I want you to look up that information and to absorb it, because we can only move forward. We can only do better by knowing where we come from. Right.
Yeah. That's
but
right.
I also just want just a word of caution in that if you are reading something, make sure that you look it up further. Just fall down the rabbit hole a little bit. Make sure that what you're reading is factual and true.
Yeah. Facts on facts. Amen.
Yes. And.
So we are going to pivot. But please, as always, we love if you email us. Or you want to tweet at us and continue this discussion further. I mean, to be honest, like, we're not going to engage with neo-Nazis. So if a neo-Nazi hears this, you'll get no answer from us, because I don't have time for you.
No.
And that's, I don't care what anybody thinks. I have no time.
There's no, you can't talk to these people.
No, and my time on Earth is too precious to waste
absolutely.
On you. So, peace.
I'd rather love.
And so, speaking of education, I feel like this is a decent pivot, since we were talking about the things that are happening in Florida. Is the Museum of Broadway is offering educational curriculum to student groups that come to visit. So they will offer they'll also offer curriculum for before you get there. And then they'll also offer some for while the student groups are there. And that some of the themes that will be available are the making of a Broadway show, musical theater as a genre. And I love this one. Identity politics on stage, retelling history on stage.
Yes.
Right. And then, of course, adaptations and rewriting for theater. So,
yeah, which is what they essentially did with Death of a Salesman. Not necessarily rewriting, but it was a retelling of the story from a different point of view. Diversity wise.
It's really great. So that's very exciting. And the lesson plans will be age appropriate. And it's wonderful. This is like a really wonderful addition that, like, I'm happy there's a Museum of Broadway, and I'm also happy that they are offering like educational workshops and resources for school groups. This is wonderful.
Totally. And I want to go. Do you want to go to the museum with me?
Yeah. 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 I absolutely do. I absolutely do. So we're going to do that and go to parade, because we also are scheduling that.
I'm cool so beans. Excited.
Okay. And so then also, like, continuing to go with that theme, there's an article in the Financial Times, and it's specifically about Lin-Manuel.
Easy for you to say.
I know. Usually it is. I cannot believe I chuffed up that. That's wild.
It just rolls off your tongue.
I know. Usually it does. And it's specifically about Lin-Manuel Miranda's working the way that he's been working uptown to make sure that, like, the arts community uptown is being seen within their own community, right? Instead of having to always go downtown to Midtown to be seen. And so, you know, most of us sort of know that this began, you know, specifically with him trying to sort of rebuild spaces up there for things to be seen, with the 175th Street, like, Palace Theater, which I've been to several times. It's absolutely gorgeous, totally incredible.
Nice.
And so he was working on that even before Hamilton. Like he was literally writing Hamilton and doing that. And then there is every summer. And to be honest, as a New Yorker, it's sad. I didn't even really know this is happening. But in my defense, New York City has so many things going on. I literally can't keep up. And so I'm only feeling 50% terrible. Because I just can't see everything. But there's a thing every summer called the Uptown Art Stroll. And it's been happening since 2003. And so now we're at the 20-year mark. And it's now it went from like being 1 or 2 days to now it's like a month-long celebration.
Cool.
And it happens in Northern Manhattan's West Harlem, Washington Heights, and Inwood as well. And it's like
my
just
old
everything.
Neighborhood.
Sure is. Sure is. And I have friends up in Inwood who will just be like, yeah, we saw Lynn at the grocery store. and so the Miranda family's been working with NOMA, which is the Northern Manhattan Arts Alliance, for several years to do this. And this sort of deals with the thing that like Pamela and I talk a lot about and my friends and I talk a lot about, which is also about accessibility.
Right.
And accessibility is like many pronged, right? Like I'm also very interested in accessibility as it pertains to people with disabilities and chronic illnesses. And I'm extremely concerned about our lack of attention to this, especially after COVID, and how, you know, there was such hope about us understanding that we need to make space more accessible for people who are immunocompromised. And instead, we are just like pretending like COVID never happened or isn't happening right now, you know. And so
back to normal. People got vaccinated, so we're fine.
Well, but a lot of people didn't.
No, I know. I was being sarcastic.
Yeah, right, right. You know, and so like I'm very concerned about that. And as I continue to, you know, sort of put on my producing hat, I'm trying to be very aware of like, am I creating spaces that are like safe for immunocompromised people and also like just accessible for individuals whose like mobility or different things are barriers to them coming to the theater. So I look forward to having some control over like spaces I create, but I wish other people who have spaces that they create would also pay attention to this, because I have friends who like legitimately stopped going to the theater because they just can't.
That's sad.
It is.
Well, it's because it's also like you look at the amount of vast resources that these producers and theater owners have and that they aren't doing anything with them in order to make it physically accessible for people. We also have an issue with it being financially accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is my biggest complaint.
It's a huge issue. And it's also, I mean, it's another one that like Lynn took into consideration when Hamilton happened, you know. That's why they had those $10, it was $10 Wednesdays, where it's like all the students throughout all five boroughs, it was like $10 they had to pay to come see a show with their school.
Nice. Oh, nice.
And, yeah. And so I believe that's still happening as far as I know. Please somebody tell me if I'm wrong and it is no longer happening. But it was in conjunction with the Rockefeller Foundation. And so, you know, he's trying to make Broadway more accessible. He's also trying to create spaces for people in his neighborhood to show their art and make it so that, again, it's not one day, it's like month long, and they don't have to, you know, only be accepted downtown to be able to show off the work that they're doing. And so this is like super, this is really exciting. I'm continuously proud of him. Even though I don't know him for anything. And
Well, I think that's a testament to how accessible he is.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And he does say in this article, I try to make myself available to everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I loved that. So because part of it had to do with Stephen Sondheim. Stephen Sondheim did the same thing. Like, he would reach out to fledgling or new composers, lyricists, show writers, and give them critiques and try to uplift them and try to support them in whatever way that he could. Mm-hmm. And Lin-Manuel said in that interview that he wants to do the same thing now that Stephen Sondheim is gone and not no longer able to do that. He wants to step in and do that for younger creators now.
Yeah, he did say that. And I have friends with like letters they got from Stephen that are framed and like in their homes and stuff, because he was kind. Yeah, he was really kind.
Well, Tick Tick Boom has a whole plot sequence about that.
Right.
Stephen Sondheim reaches out to Jonathan Larson, leaves him a voicemail on his answering machine that said, hey, this is what I think you need. Want to give me a call and we can chat about it. So, like, he's, you know, he was accessible too.
He was. And that in the movie, that was one of his last two performances, was doing his own voicemail. I know, it's like this little nugget for all of us. The other one was, well, I'm not going to spoil it if folks haven't seen the movie yet, but there's another movie he's in, which was also one of his last performances. And also one of the last times my other favorite human was on screen. All right. So next thing we want to talk about is, this is going to be the last thing for this episode, which is probably pretty long already. And this one, this is the reopening of La Mama. It's an off-Broadway sort of incubator for new work. And it went through a couple of years of renovation, and it got reopened with Andre DeShields emceeing, because, I mean, it was one of his artistic homes when he was coming up. And it was so fun to like watch the video and see like the whole neighborhood just sort of come out, and all these different people, you know, like different ethnic backgrounds, ages, like everybody's all over the place. And they were ringing bells, which the woman who founded it, like that's what she would do. I think it was when a new show started. And so when they opened it, that's what they all did. Like, you'll see in the video, they're all like ringing bells. It was a Pix 11, which is a news resource we have up here in New York City, did a story on them, and they were showing that. Cool. And it was just so delightful. And unfortunately, we've sort of had this string of new work incubators close in New York City. And so, you know, due to funding, COVID, so many different situations where they just couldn't stay open. And honestly, like, not even just the last 3 years, like, it's been over large portions of time, even before, you know, Pamela and I were here, or before we were born. You know, I have friends who are older than me and were here like in the 80s, and they talked about just all these different like little theaters and basements and stuff where they were able to create things that eventually became, you know, sort of classics of the stage. And, you know, so the fact that La Mama was able to have this revitalization and be able to like come back and offer space to people to create new work is really exciting. And also adds a lot of hope. You know, we started this episode on a lot of frustration about what's happening, but, you know, it also comes back to, you know, I wanted us to end with looking at all the wonderful things that people are trying to do, because people are doing great things. They are trying to open up spaces. They are trying to open up opportunities. And so just like I said at the beginning of this episode, if every one of us decides in the morning we're going to make a better choice, then that better choice will influence other people. You know, they'll be affected by that. And that just keeps going and going and going. It's like sort of a little bit of that like pay it forward idea. And so, yeah, friends, there's a lot of cause for hope. There's a lot of cause for despair. But like, you know, it starts with you just making better, smarter, more inclusive, more equitable choices so that spaces become better for everyone. So, yes. So that's it.
Ah, that was good. It was cathartic. It was nice.
It was good.
I hope you guys felt the same way.
Yeah. And as always, you know, like hit us up on the emails, on the socials, wherever you like. And, you know, too, like if you want more information on these specific, you know, like Leo Frank and that whole story and things like that, like we're happy to whatever we know or whatever links we can send you, or you know, if you're interested in knowing also about the street and Camp Siegfried and these other camps that were up here. I also have a great story about one town called Southington, Connecticut, which was in Connecticut, that absolutely said no to somebody trying to build a neo-Nazi camp up there.
Wow.
And it's a wonderful story. And there's a documentary about it. And so again, more cause for hope. So if anybody's interested in knowing more about that, I'm like happy to offer that, you know, how to email us.
Yes.
And that's it.
All right. If nothing else, all of the lights have been turned on. Nobody's going to be hiding in the shadows anymore.
That's right. Amen. Thanks for listening, friends.
Yes, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Theater Geeks Anonymous. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at
TGABway and on Facebook at Theater Geeks Anonymous.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the Theater Geeks Anonymous podcast
on the Broadway Podcast Network and all your favorite podcast listening apps.
Your intermission-sode has now concluded.
Shut up, sit down, and turn off your cell phones. Or we'll tell Patti LuPone.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.